Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the press briefing at the UN office at Geneva today, the 4th of July. Happy 4th of July to you out there. We have another very, very packed agenda. I'm going to start off immediately with our friend Ed Harris from WIPO, but I just wanted to mention we have colleagues who are joining us from Kabul, from Gaza, from Yangon, and we also have announcements from our colleagues from UNICEF. And we also have an addition to the agenda, which I'd like to flag now. We have a Mr. Henri Monceau, who's a permanent observer of the OEF, who is going to make an announcement towards the end of this briefing. So apologies for not having that in the schedule that we sent out earlier, but we will have Mr. Monceau, who will speak at the end. So we'll start off immediately with Mr. Harris, and then move on to our colleagues in the field. Ed.
Thank you, Orlando. Good morning, everybody. A real fast word about the WIPO assemblies taking place next week and the following week, beginning on Tuesday, July 8th through Thursday, July 17th. We're expecting 1,000-plus delegates, including 40 or so ministers for these meetings, which will be reviewing the program of work for the 26-27 biennium. So WIPO's on a two-year biennial work plan. They'll also be looking at program activities and reviewing them from the previous years. For you in the press, we have lots of very interesting side events and other activities that I hope you can find some time in your calendar to come and check out. On Wednesday, July 9th, we have the launch of the World Intangible Investment Highlights Report. We'll be sending out a press release around 8:30 in the morning on Wednesday. This is looking at 2024 activity as well as longer-term trends in investments in data, software, research and development, brand, and other intellectual property-backed assets that are increasingly important to global GDP. So this is different than tangible investments, which are more like in factories and physical assets. Friday, July 11th, the WIPO Global Awards, also a press release, an announcement and ceremony at WIPO with 10 winners of this new enterprise, which we launched 2 years ago. This celebrates small businesses, startups, and university spin-outs that leverage IP-backed innovation and creation in an exceptional manner to not only achieve their business goals, but have some positive social impact. There's also lots of member state activities, cultural and otherwise, that will be highlighting innovation and activity in those places. Among them are China, India, Oman, Armenia, Albania, Peru, Indonesia, Grenada, and Qatar. So you can find all the information about this through our website. And if you think you'd like to come on over and see us, just give me a heads up in advance. Thank you, Londo.
Great. Thank you, Ed. That's a lot of very important information there. I think we do have a question in the room. No, we do have one online. John Zarakostas is pointing a question to you. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning, Ed. Nice to see you in the briefing room. Two questions. Your flagship report that you launched every spring on performance and trademarks, patents, industrial designs, I didn't see it launched this year, or did I miss it?
We put that out in late February or early March. It's a review of the use of WIPO's IP services in the previous year. So patents, trademarks, industrial designs, and others. I can send it over to you, no problem. John, you can check it out.
Okay, thanks, Ed. John, did you have a quick follow-up on that, further clarification?
Yeah, Ed, just not to confuse it, the one that tracks the performance on the previous year of how many patents, trademarks were registered. Is that the one we're talking about?
That's right. There's one that is in February, which refers to the previous year's activities through WIPO. So that's a subset of total activity around the world. And in November every year, there's another similar but quite distinct report, which looks at global activity. So sometimes business owners, enterprises, others will file IP rights in their own country, but they don't necessarily go international. So when they do, they come through WIPO very frequently, and that's what we do in February, whereas the larger report is in November, but for the previous year. Hope that's clear.
I think that's pretty clear. Thanks very much, Ed. No further questions for you, so thanks and good luck to you.
Thank you.
All the best. Okay, now we're going to turn to our friend Babar on my left here from UNHCR, who's going to introduce a colleague who's joining us from Kabul to speak to the situation in Afghanistan. Babar.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, dears. my colleague Arafat Jamal, who's head of UNHCR operations in Afghanistan, he's our representative in Kabul, is joining us again. Will update us on the increasing number of Afghans who are returning from Iran. Remember, he joined us on 20th of May, raising our concerns then, but things have worsened since. Then we issued a statement over the weekend alerting you what was happening, but just now to give you latest update from Afghanistan. Arafat Jan, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Babarjan and colleagues. As said, I'm speaking to you today from Kabul. UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is urgently seeking funding to protect over 1.4 million who have returned or been forced to return to Afghanistan so far this year, including over 1 million from Iran. Daily returns from Iran increased significantly after the 13th of June, with the highest number recorded on the 1st of July, when over 43,000 people returned. This is a stark increase from the January to June average of around 5,000 arrivals per day. Arrivals from Pakistan increased sharply in April, when nearly 150,000 people returning that month. Our teams are at the borders, receiving and assisting streams of exhausted, hungry, and scared people every day. Staff and structures are absolutely inundated. UNHCR has deployed additional staff, and we are providing essential relief items, hot meals, and emergency financial assistance to help meet immediate needs. But amid funding constraints and given the scale and pace of returns, we will not be able to sustain support for more than a few weeks. These returns are part of a complex protection crisis. And we at UNHCR are concerned that the returns are happening in extremely difficult conditions and that some of them are not voluntary. Many people who have returned have said that they have felt compelled to leave as they saw other fellow Afghans being deported. Returnees who arrived in Afghanistan in the past months have been sharing concerning stories of increasing restrictions, harassment, and discrimination. Colleagues, the last time I addressed this group was on the 20th of May, around 1.5 months ago. At that time, we were seeing an uptick in returns from Pakistan. Since then, we have had the so-called 12-day war in Iran. And although the bombs have stopped, the human consequences persist. I was at the border myself on the 24th of June, on the day that a ceasefire was announced. And what I saw was the human consequences of this war, of people streaming in, a people doubly uprooted from Afghanistan, but hardly of this country, many of whom were born in Tehran and other places, many of whom hardly knew where they come from, stripped of belongings, having undertaken perilous, difficult, and exhausting journeys. They seemed to know not what to do in Afghanistan. UNHCR urges countries in the region to ensure that returns to Afghanistan are voluntary, safe, and dignified. Forcing or putting pressure on Afghans to return risks further instability in the region and onward movements towards Iran, Turkey, and Europe. UNHCR calls upon the international community to urgently and substantially increase funding to meet both critical needs at the border upon arrival and to provide longer-term assistance to help returnees settle back in Afghanistan. UNHCR's response in Afghanistan this year, which is already a prioritized response, is only 28% funded. We implore you, the international community, to not turn your back on the people of Afghanistan at this pivotal moment. To stand with them to restore hope and to give them a fighting chance of recovery, stability, and prosperity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Arafat. We'll turn to questions. We have one for you from our colleague from AFP, the French News Agency. Christophe.
Good morning, Mr. Jamal. Christophe Vogt, Agence France-Presse. I actually had two questions. One on, you said that the funding is only met 28%. Can you tell us how much money you actually need in total, how much you think you need with this new arrivals? And the second question has to do with an interview that the German Interior Minister gave yesterday, where he said basically that he was going to talk to the Taliban to be able to send Afghans back to their country from Germany. So I would like a comment from you. And if our if people from the Human Rights Office are online, I would also ask them to chip in with a comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you so much to the colleague from AFP. Regarding the first question on the funding, so our total budget, which includes both the borders and the border response, is for 216 million. So that is only 20% funded. So we need around 170 million additional. That is, as I said, a highly prioritized budget to start with. Secondly, regarding the question on returns from Germany, I would just remind everyone that UNHCR continues to have a non-return advisory to Afghanistan. In other words, what we feel that the objectively speaking, the conditions on the ground are not yet ready for returns. That does not exclude voluntary returns, of course, but we urge countries not to forcibly return Afghans.
Thank you very much, Arafat. I'm not sure. I believe Ravina is connected. Ravina,
if I am connected.
Hi, yes, Ravina. Thanks. If you heard the question, or do you need to be repeated?
It's on returns to Afghanistan, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Wait, sorry, I mean, maybe Christophe, maybe if Christophe could rephrase
it. Hi, Ravina, nice to see you. Just to clarify, it's about the comment, the German Interior Minister has given an interview yesterday where he said he wants to get in touch with the Taliban authorities to be able to send Afghans back from Germany to Afghanistan. So I would like to know what you think of that.
Right. No, thank you. Thanks for repeating that, Christophe. I would, of course, echo what our UNHCR colleague has said. It is not appropriate to return people to Afghanistan. We have been documenting continuing human rights violations in Afghanistan, particularly violations of the rights of women and girls who have effectively been rendered invisible, who have been stripped of their voices, of their rights to employment, to education, to freedom of movement. But we've also continued to document other instances of human rights violations, including executions that have been carried out. So indeed, it is not appropriate to be talking about returning people to Afghanistan at this point.
Thank you so much, Ravina, for the questions. Christophe, maybe just to remind you, colleagues, earlier this week, UNAMA, that's a UN assistance mission in Afghanistan, issued a report providing a grim update of the human rights situation in the country, in Afghanistan, with a focus on the rights of women and girls, as Ravina just mentioned, and talks of women in Afghanistan still being denied the opportunity to join the workforce, accessing services without a male relative, and girls are still deprived of the right to education. And just one other note on Afghanistan, if I may, just to remind you that Mr. Fletcher, Tom Fletcher, the humanitarian coordinator, was in the country earlier this week. We also released a record $16.6 million to help vulnerable communities to mitigate the effects of drought, which is a compounding factor to the refugee situation, which you just heard about. So just wanted to flag that for you to put things in a broader context. Okay, further questions for our colleague from Kabul, in Kabul, rather. No, I don't see that's the case. I don't know if Babar has anything more to add or?
No, we are here in case there are more queries that may come up later, so do let us know. And huge thanks, Arafat Jan, joining us from Kabul.
Yeah, echoing those thanks. Thank you so much, Arafat, and please do join us again. And thanks for keeping us updated. All the best and good luck to you. Okay, colleagues, so we're going to switch. Thank you again, Babar, for joining us, as always. I'm going to switch over to the situation in Gaza. We have Dr. Pieperkorn, who, as you know, is the WHO's representative in the occupied Palestinian territory. But maybe I'll turn to Christian first from WHO to introduce, to start off, and maybe if you had something to add at the beginning, and you can throw to Rick afterwards. Christian.
Yeah, thank you very much, and very glad to have us again. And then thanks for Rick this time talking out of Gaza. Very grim situation, as you've seen it all around in the recent days. A lot of different press conference and pressure from all sides. Therefore, thanks to Rick, and over to Rick from Gaza.
I think you're muted, Rick. Maybe try again.
All right.
Go ahead.
So good morning, Rolando and all. Can you hear me loud and clear?
Yes, we can. Thanks.
All right. So greetings from Darabala. So I want to give an update, a general update, and then specifically a focus on Shifa and Nasr medical complex and talk a little bit about the Medevac. Just a general update. This senseless killing in Gaza must stop. These multiple attacks, which we see in recent days, actually for weeks now, hitting sites, hosting displaced people, specifically people trying to access food, you know, have been killed and injured. They've killed and injured scores and scores Palestinians. So if you look at the overall figures, and you know, and we were yesterday evening discussed that since October 2023, it's estimated that more than 57,000 people have been killed, and over close to 135,000 people injured. And we all know, you've seen this also from various assessments, that this is an underestimation. Even if you take these figures, it translates into an estimated 90 people being killed per day and 200 injured per day in Gaza. The health system, what we see is on its knees amid shortages of medical supplies, fuel, and a huge influx in injuries. No fuel has entered Gaza over the 120 days. And for us, for WHO, supplying fuel to the health facility, it means that we constantly have to prioritize the limited fuel reserves in northern and southern Gaza, barely enough to keep 70, partially, I would say, some minimal functional hospitals, facilities running for a short period. A limited quantity of UN fuel reserves are in areas currently inaccessible, but of course, new fuel needs to come from outside. Now, let me say something on Tuesday when we went to the north and had a visit at Shifa for three reasons with a WHO mission. So first was to bring in some fuel. Secondly, to collect patients from the north for a medevac on Wednesday. And of course, we also did an assessment on Shifa and then with the staff. And all around. Lack of fuel, crippling Shifa Hospital is compounded by a stream of never-ending injuries. The hospital is operating at a minimum capacity and for example, have to be forced to reduce services. They constantly play for its fuel, you know, what is bad, to preserve fuel for critical care. One operating theater is down. The dialysis sessions, which should be ideally three times a week for 4 hours. They cut down to 2 days for 3 hours. Oxygen plants has been stopped, forcing reliance again on the cylinders. The hospital overwhelmed, severely under-resourced by more or less everything. The beds are full and patients are once again being treated on the floor. 13 patients in ICU dependent on life supports, which will cut off if power runs out. Hundreds of patients are coming in daily. 10th majority have a combination of multiple injuries. We'll discuss it later more specifically from Nasser. Head, neck injury, bone injury, abdominal, draining the limited resources in fast race. We managed to deliver 3,000 liters of fuel to the hospitals and what I said, get patients out. but it's only enough for probably a week or something, less than a week, supporting to expand. We also, as WHO, we are looking together with partners to expand. There's a constant lack of beds, so to expand the capacity with a number of tents, like a little field hospital within the Shifa compound. Let me switch to Nasrallah complex, and you know, having been so often to all those hospitals, that was a bit of a shock. Yesterday, we spent a lot of time there with the team, with the director, his team, etc. The hospital is, this is not a normal general. Now, Nasser Medical Complex is the most important hospital in Gaza currently. It is serving almost all, it was serving kind of all, let's say, referral departments, which you would need. It has been constantly, and we warned about that, being shifting within evacuation zone, just bordering an evacuation zone, again within an evacuation zone, and now again just bordering an evacuation zones, which of course has massive implications, not just for patients, but also for staff. And that's maybe the first message Nasser Medical Complex needs to be protected. It's the most important hospital for referral and critical patients. It needs to continue functioning. It needs to be protected. So currently, they've seen already for weeks daily injuries in the tens and hundreds. Majority coming from the so-called safe non-UN food distribution site. The hospital is now, you cannot even call it a general referral hospital, it's operating as one massive trauma ward. The max for Nasser Medical Complex is 300 to 350 patients. They have close to 700 patients now, and with limited resources and fuel. So they, just like Shifa, but even starker in Nasser Medical Complex, they constantly have to make the difficult choice to deprioritize patients, for example, with chronic diseases in the hospitals, but also the OPDs. So patients with diabetes, cardiac, but also mental health. It was one of the few places where there was a bit of mental health care OPD. It's not there anymore because they only focus on trauma patients and in order to save life in the emergency rooms and the operation theaters. A WHO kind of field hospital within Nasser, which was mainly there for, we used it sometimes for medevac, and then it was used as a pediatric ward. It's all trauma patients. The archive, they rebuilt the archive in Nasser Medical Complex is now one trauma ward. You see patients everywhere on the floor, in the corridors, etc., including a lot of ad hoc intensive care units, which they have created within the emergency ward and on other places. Besides their own intensive care unit is 12 beds. There's more than 60 patients on intensive care all over. And people get intubated in front of your eyes on stretchers, on the floor, etc. So, but even this non-treatment or this lack of treatment of this so-called more chronic diseases will also have is another unnecessary increase of preventable deaths, morbidity, and of course suffering. Again, we went around and we spent hours there, and so we witnessed firsthand the impact of this mass casualty incidents and violence at the so-called safe non-UN food distribution site. Besides this tens, hundreds of patients, you know, we could pick out so many cases, and yesterday we saw and we discussed with his family, his fathers, etc. First, a 13-year-old boy shot in the head, fighting off for his life, being quadriplegic, etc., in the emergency room. And his father, I mean, like approaching me, you know, you need to assist me. My boy needs to be medevaced out. They cannot do anything here, etc. And completely traumatized and overwhelmed. Another, because what type of trauma patients do we see? It's mainly boys young adolescents, young men, etc. And we all know, because they go to this so-called safe non-UN food distribution sites. And you see, and the staff told me that and couldn't believe that. So there are so many of these cases, shot in the head, shot in the neck, shot in the chest, being shot in the abdomen, on the knees, etc. And besides, we saw another, I mean, we talked again with a family from the other one, father, and it is deeply distressing for this, for all those families. A 16-year-old, another 16-year-old as well, with a shot in the head, fighting for his life, on a stretcher, being intubated, etc. And the same story, a 21-year-old, still a boy, with a bullet still lodged in his neck, and quadriplegic, of course, which we all know. I mean, like being quadriplegic or paraplegic in any location, any place, but here in Gaza, no chance for any reversal, but also no chance for any even closely proper treatment. So all those lives, young life, destroyed for forever. And what you see, you talk to the father, the only thing they say, like, how can you help us? You know, what can WHO do? They think that we are kind of, that we can medevac everyone and that will help. It will not. It was deeply, deeply distressing. Anyhow, they all these children were raised with dreams and they wanted to do something, and no parent is actually prepared to witness this. So there's no roadmap for this kind of heartbreak. It's just this long, quiet ache of knowing life will never go back to what it was. Nasser Hospital remains close to evacuation zone, and we again raise it needs to be protected. A small thing on meningitis, because you might have heard about it, and it also very much linked to various ones, specifically in Nasser. So there's been a rise in meningitis cases in children, mostly viral, with some bacterial as well. Viral meningitis is almost never a life-threatening. I want to say bacterial meningitis, of course, is extremely serious, life-threatening illnesses. This data, we are monitoring it with the WHO team, Ministry of Health. They are ongoing. There is normally, you see a spike in meningitis in this time. So it's June to August, etc. And although we are, of course, very concerned and we have to monitor this very closely, there seems to be more cases. And is this because of crowding and everything else related to that? The overcrowding in shelters in the camp, the absence of basic hygiene, the disruption of routine vaccination, inadequate access to healthcare, etc. The problem for the hospitals is that we talk to the pediatricians and the nurses at that little pediatric ward. They have a lot of difficulties to differentiate that because they lack the lab supplies, they lack especially the rapid tests and the lack supplies. So they have to use sometimes their limited supplies of antibiotics for both. They were asking us for increased supplies of vancomycin and of course this ratrovir for the viral one. Last point I want to raise is on the medevac. So let's say on meningitis, we're carefully monitoring. We need to get the cultures in and improve the diagnostics, help to improve the diagnostic. That's why we need the supplies in. And of course, adequate the right type antibiotics. Medical evacuation. So on Wednesday, 2nd of July, again, we evacuated 19 child patients to Jordan, with 39 companions, and to Turkey, 4 patients and 7 companions. I want to thank also very much Jordan and Turkey for that. During strikes, actually en route, there were strikes very close to holding points. It was completely unacceptable near the convoy. It damaged bus, ambulances, and vehicles, but caused of course, huge anxiety among patients and their companions. Fortunately, no injuries and very distressing. So since 18th of March, only seven medical evacuations have taken place, 370 patients and 504 companions. We had an assessment again in Shifa and Nasser. We still estimate very much that at least 10,000 people need medical evacuations. We want all routes to open up, including to East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Last point I want to say on supplies. So the supply routes need to be opened up. There are supplies of WHO in Al-Arish and in other places, etc. And what Nasser said, they could provide us with an endless list. They were shorter, so specifically anything around anesthesia, anything around trauma, etc. All those regular specific antibiotics, etc. Cultures, lab supplies is very much needed. Let me end with maybe four messages. We all know what is needed. Gaza needs to be flooded with food. Flood the markets with food. It will stop the mass casualty incidents. It will stop also the fighting for food, the desperate fighting. So flood the markets with food. Make sure that wash and water is supplied. Make sure that essential medicine, medical supplies, and of course, a regular supply of fuel. Last but not least, we really need that ceasefire now. There's a lot of talk about it everywhere in the media. Let it happen. Let it happen now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rick, for this important update, as heartbreaking as it is. And maybe just to mention the various points you mentioned, your comprehensive update were echoed by the Secretary General in a statement that he shared with you yesterday, colleagues, in response to the deepening humanitarian crisis, in particular the recent multiple attacks hitting sites hosting displaced people. The statement refers to the relocation of nearly 30,000 people to flee just in one day this week, colleagues. So as Rick said, fuel is an issue, medicine, shelter, water, all these issues were mentioned in the Secretary General's statement, which we shared with you last night. So thanks again, Rick. We'll go now for questions. Let me turn immediately to Antonio, because I think you've had your hand up very early. Is this for Rick?
No, it was for UNHCR, sorry.
I thought maybe it was, because I didn't see your hand up earlier. If I could ask you if this is on Afghanistan or another issue, because I'd like to take questions on Gaza first.
No, it's about DRC, actually.
DRC. Okay, if you could hold on to that thought, and I'll get back to you on the DRC, but let's take questions on Gaza first. We have one from Olivia of Reuters.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peppercorn. Just starting with Al-Shifa, I just wanted to double check. Did you say 13 patients on life support would be cut off if fuel runs out? That's my first question. On meningitis, do you have any data in terms of the kinds of numbers you're seeing in terms of that increase at this stage in meningitis cases? If you have the breakdown as well between viral and bacterial, that would be great. And just in terms of the injuries you said were being seen at Nasser Hospital, you're talking about non-UN sites. Can we confirm you're directly talking about the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and their operation? And secondly, in terms of that, I just want to put a comment to you that they've consistently said to us, which is that people are not being injured or killed at their sites and have been pointing instead to other humanitarian organizations and their aid distribution. So some clarity there would be great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On Shifa, I can confirm that there's 13 patients on the ICU. I mean, there's many more in Nasser, as I explained. And of course, they are only dependent on fuel. And not only that, also hemodialysis, the operation theaters, et cetera, et cetera. So that is That's very important. But in Shifa, there is 13. On the meningitis, the data, they're being worked on, because it's quite, as I said, it's really difficult for the hospitals to make even this differentiation between viral and meningitis. It's mainly on clinical signs, because they don't have culture, they can do the test, they can do a lumbar puncture and see some base. So they can do a little bit and suspect, okay, this is most likely not bacterial, but it is complex. It runs overall in a couple of hundreds of cases. I mean, like that is clear, probably around 300, what I understand from my colleagues. But it's very important that we analyze better. So what happened in the years before? Because normally you see an increase in between June and August. What we got from the yesterday our visit in Nasser, so the teams are working and analyzing that. But it's really difficult to get all this data from these hospitals. It took us, for example, 2 hours to go from Derabala to Nasser. That's already insane. It used to be 10 minutes or something like that. It took us 2 hours because people have moved, etc. So we need better data to speak out that more clearly, and if we have that, we will share it with you. And of course, it's very important we know, is this more of an increase? Is this more of an increase than compared to the last couple of years? We are, of course, concerned that specifically because of the overcrowding, etc., the bad hygiene conditions, etc., the lack. Well, I think that the vaccination programs would all have been effective, etc. And of course, the overall status of kids in my on that one as well. Now, the injuries, you talked about that, the injuries which we saw in Nasser, they were all confirmed by the health workers, but also by the families. So it's reported by the families. I mean, that's really important, that they actually came from these so-called safe non-UN food distribution sites. We also know there's mass casual incidents when trucks, for example, we have seen that also in reports, and some of the UN trucks come in. And this is why I made this point. Gaza needs to be flooded by food. So you stop that scramble from food, from desperate people, for maybe organized people who want to to get a hand on the food, etc. The markets need to be flooded. And we saw that also when there was the ceasefire, that very quickly any looting around everywhere or any violence, it stopped, it subsided. And I think what we have seen since this crisis constantly, and I think that should concern all of us, that it seems every time the situation goes a little better, there's again a squeeze. There's a squeeze and there's a kind of a blockade, or it becomes very difficult for UN and partners to distribute within Gaza. And we're getting squeezed, and the situation, which is already disastrous, becomes, I cannot even describe it, beyond the disastrous. And then again, there's a little bit of relaxation and a few trucks come in. And of course, I mean, like, desperate people go crazy. I mean, like, people are hungry, and there is so young boys are sent out to get some food for their families. That's what one of his fathers told. He first didn't want to allow his son of 21 years, his youngest son of 21 years, and then finally, okay, you know, yeah, maybe it's a good idea. You go there and you get some a little food supply. And it was very tragic, because it was a neighbor from one of the hospital works we discussed. So life, I mean, life is almost like is worth one bag of flour or something like that. That's the insane thing, what is happening. And it's in a majority of the casualties directly reported to us by the health workers, but also by the families, was all related to this so-called safe non-UN food distribution site. There's definitely also, I mean, we've seen also mass casualty incidents happening around other trucks which came in, etc. It can all be stopped if the market is flooded by food. Over to you.
Thanks, Rick. I think Olivia has a follow-up. Go ahead.
Hi, Rick. Sorry, I'm just going to go back to you on that. I just need to be really clear because we obviously need to be as accurate as possible in our reporting of this. And are we specifically talking about sites which are related to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation? Because I understand whose position, but we need, given these are allegations, we would need to put them to whoever is responsible. So if you're able to please clarify, are we specifically speaking about sites operated by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation? And just secondly, I forgot to ask if you had an idea of numbers in terms of dozens, hundreds, in terms of the numbers of people who were injured from these sites coming to Nasser. Thank you very much.
Well, look, we of course, as WHO team, we are not at this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation so-called safe distribution sites. We are not there. So we see, we witness the consequence of that. And we get a report. We get the reports, not just from the patients, their families, if they cannot speak anymore because they're paraplegic, quadriplegic, or whatever, from their families, their friends who are with them, etc. And yes, I mean, from them, based on their reports, the majority of these injuries, and I think we have been reporting on this, not only we, but I think many other agencies, many other NGOs, that please, I mean, like there's been so many statements on this, has been reported that the majority of these injuries is related to the so-called non-UN food distribution sites, which are run by GHM. So yes.
Thank
but we as WHO, we are not at those sites. So I cannot count, okay, this amount of people are being shot, et cetera, and whatever at this site, and this amount of people at that site. So it's being reported to us. I hope I'm clear. Thanks.
I think that clarifies things. Let me just echo what our spokespeople in New York said and what we've been saying here in terms of this scheme, this foundation. You know, this does not meet the most basic standards required by us for humanitarian delivery, what we need when we're trying to help people. We're trying to help people, not put them at risk. And this scheme certainly does not meet that high standard that we require. Further questions in the room? And then, okay, I'll turn to colleagues online. Antonia, I'll come back to you. I have a question from Elaine and then from Imogen. Elaine first.
Thanks. This may not be something that Rick can answer either. This is from Health Policy Watch. But when we did a story on this chaos last week, I found at least two incidents in which there were mass casualties of 20 to 40 people around UN distribution sites as well. So it seemed to be, for us, to be more linked to the open fire rules and the way the Army was managing all of the access points rather than specifically to GHF. But so I just would love some further clarification on how many UN deliveries are happening as well and where. It seemed to us it was mostly in the northern Gaza that there were new UN deliveries and the south, GHF sites were concentrated in the south. But again, anybody that could clarify that would be much appreciated. And also another question that may not be in the purview of this presser, but has occurred to me is understanding how the flow of aid worked previously from the UN distribution, the UN trucks or the UN distribution points to families. I mean, was aid distributed just directly to families? Was it to soup kitchens mainly? How did supplies get to the market? You know, that whole chain of flow previously would be just good to understand for background. Thank you.
Rick, do you want to tackle that?
Yeah, I think maybe you can add on this one as well, and another time a WFP colleague, etc. So, one thing, of course, what we get reported, and again, I want to stress that reported by the patients, their families, their friends, the health workers, that the majority of injuries we see are related to this so-called injuries, traumatic injuries. Yeah, the majority by far related to the so-called non-UN food distribution sites. That's one. Two, I already reported there's mass casualty incidents with any group of trucks coming into Gaza. And we all know why, because way too little food and any supplies comes in. There was a blockade for how much? For more than 12 weeks. And after that, just a trickle what came in. And on all areas, definitely also on food. So any supplies which come in, you get this, you get hundreds. And we've seen it as well. I mean, like when we were traveling, that people moving, when there is suspicion that trucks are coming in, hundreds of mainly young boys, men, etc., will flood that, etc. It's a sign of desperation. It's also definitely an ugly sight of looting, etc. And yeah, so I think Elaine is right. I mean, like on the story, it's a combination, but the majority of trauma injuries definitely up till now related to the so-called non-UN distribution sites. So again, the plea, food, the market should be flooded by food, and you will take this away quite quickly. And on the actual distribution, you have to discuss with WFP and maybe OCHA, but there were definitely a range of community distribution sites, and it will need to go back to that. Over to you.
Thanks, Rick. Elaine, there's not much I can add. I won't repeat what I just said about this foundation. What I can do is remind you that, you know, our teams, our humanitarian teams in Gaza, they require to coordinate their movements with the Israeli authorities. Now, what I can tell you is that during the month of June, out of nearly 400 such coordination attempts, only 44% were outright denied by the Israeli authorities. Another 10% were initially accepted but faced impediments. So it's an absolutely dramatic theater they're working in, very difficult, as we know. Rick spelled it out in detail. I just referred to the relocation orders again, and these are people who've been relocated, you know, many, many, many times over the course of these months. So it's a very complex situation. And of course, as Rick said, and as the Secretary General says, we want to deliver food to these people who are unable to move in most cases, food, water, and medical supplies as urgently as possible. But if there are colleagues perhaps connected who can add more context, please raise your hands. Thanks for the question, Elaine. Let me just turn now to Imogen. This is for Rick, I suppose. Imogen from the BBC.
Yes, it is. Thank you for taking my question. Rick, I wrote what you were saying, the first few words kind of quoting, and you said the senseless killing in Gaza must stop. You talked about multiple attacks for weeks now with people trying to access food. And you said they have killed scores and scores of Palestinians. Who is the they in that sentence?
You asked it to me. I mean, like, I think I wouldn't look. I'm not there. So as I said, we are not there at the sites. We don't know who's shooting, and we only see the results of this. And the results are pretty clear, and pretty graphic, and pretty horrific. And we described this, and we try to analyze and monitor as good as possible. We try to use as many sources as possible. You've seen the reports, BBC, your own BBC reported on that. So what do you say? What do you think yourself? I mean, like, it's we are more than almost 2 years now in a crisis. And I'm a little surprised about this question, to be honest. Over to you.
Yeah, let me just say what's been said as well. I mean, if we had eyes, more eyes and ears on the ground, we would be able to obviously report. Of course, we're doing the best we can with our colleagues on the ground. I mean, there's three things we want. We want a ceasefire. We want accountability. We want justice. And we want the return of hostages. We want all these things, which is can be done. It could be done. It's been something we've been pleading for months and months and months. So of course we're hearing witness reports. Colleagues from the Human Rights Office have been reporting to you on these atrocities, as well as has WHO and other colleagues online. But this is really an appeal which will continue to echo until there's peace, a lasting peace in Gaza. So let's turn to the next question. Jamie AP.
Thank you, Rolando, and thank you, Dr. Peeperkorn, for coming to see us again. I just wanted to pick up on a phrase that you said a short while ago in response to Elaine's question, that you said that a majority of trauma injuries, definitely up until now, are related to these non-UN distribution sites. I just want to make sure that you can, can you be as clear as possible on that? What is the source? Is that from the, I presume that's from the health ministry figures that you're getting that from? And is there any sort of metrics that you are coming up with that back that up from your own side, from WHO, that can specify that that indeed is where most of the, or is it that is indeed where most of the trauma injuries are coming from? And, you know, are you compiling that information yourselves? Because that is an important metric to be able to track, if possible.
So what we're trying to do, and that I want to make, by the way, also important, although this is not specified as an attack on the healthcare, but I want to make again the point on attacks on the healthcare. WHO role there is to, with the mandate by the member states, is to monitor, analyze, and report on that. We never attribute, we're not a crime investigating bureau. So I want to make that point clear. Now, on your question as well, I think that we have provided, not only we, but others as well, the figures. And if they are reported figures, we mention that they are reported figures. We do this all the time. What we can say, not just from our teams who are actually working with these hospitals to assist with mass casualty incidents, to prepare, to bring supplies, etc. They also confirm this on the spot, and the many emergency medical teams will be working on that, and which have been reporting. I mean, there's been reports and statements from a number of the NGOs and emergency medical teams as well on this topic, not just the UN, working in those hospitals. So some of these figures are Ministry of Health figures, but all those organizations, or including our team, including myself, coming here regularly, and now again, yesterday in Nasser, and on Tuesday, Shifa. So we've seen this and we witnessed that, I mean, firsthand. So should I not believe the patient myself? Should I not believe his father? Should I not believe his friend? I mean, come on. I mean, like, so we try to then compile this, deduct that, and analyze. And if they tell me that they have been shot or injured at one of those non-UN distribution sites, who am I to say, well, you know, are you sure about this? Is this not somewhere else, etc.? And there, is that who is shooting? I didn't even ask that question. I don't know that they got shot in the head, in the neck, in the chest, in the abdomen, on their knees, etc. That's definitely there. And it would be great if the press would be in National Medical complex or those hospitals, you could witness it for yourself, and you could ask those patients, you could ask the fathers, and you could ask their friends, and except the one who were completely paralyzed, of course. Over to you.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rick. Well, I was going to say one more question. We have now, Jamie, is that a follow-up before we take the final question from John?
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that I appreciate what you just said, and I understand that the accounts, you have to take them at face value. But as you rightly mentioned, you know, there's not a lot of independent press that is on site to be able to do this kind of accounting. So in that, in short, you know, because that, what I'm trying to find out is who on site is compiling these? Who are the people? A bit like what Elaine was asking about the mechanics of the aid distribution. I'm talking about the mechanics of the accounting of these individual cases. So for example, when a father or a child says, I was shot at this position from this direction by, you know, whatever, who is compiling those accounts and putting them into a sort of comprehensive, cohesive narrative by the metrics that we journalists who are not there can at least refer to, other than just raw numbers from the Ministry of Health saying this is how many people were killed. You see what I'm saying? And how can we access those accounts?
Yeah, I see your point, and I think this is also very frustrating for us. I mean, like that's and I think as Rolando also says, a lot of assessments. So first get a ceasefire, then can go in, etc. And then everywhere, not just in Gaza, also Israel and all the horrible thing what happened there. That then let independent assessments start and do their work. It's very much needed, etc. I wanna and I've reclarified this position as well. The UN is not on those sites, yeah. So we need to look at the health and health impacts and instead of the headlines or whatever, get on a blame game. And I also want to remind everyone, I remember that from the start of this crisis, the figures were questions on the number of deaths and injuries. You remind those discussions. I mean, you remember those discussions very well. The number of people overall killed and injured were constantly questioned the first couple of months by all kinds of partners, member states, etc. Ministry of Health data were very much questioned. Then all the analysis which has been done, not just by the UN, by a lot of others, published in The Lancet, published somewhere else, etc., they all confirm, in contrary, they actually said it's an underestimation. So I think we have to also be a little careful and think about, hey, where were we then, etc., what happened then? So currently, We cannot, as UN, we cannot analyze exactly, as I said, I confirmed that we see the results. I'm frustrated about that as well, and I wish, hope that we get a ceasefire, we're going to work at the future, and I think a lot of those, hopefully, independent assessments will be done within and outside Gaza. Over to you.
Thanks again, Rick. Colleagues, I'm going to turn to Ravina, who might be able to comment on some of the killings at these sites. Ravina.
Thanks, Rolando. Indeed, and also in follow-up to Imogen's question about who's responsible. So the latest figures that we have recorded 613 killings, both at GHF points and near humanitarian convoys. Now, this is a figure as of the 27th of June. Since then, I was reading our latest SITREP, there have been further incidents, 5 killed, 6 killed, 14-year-old boy shot in the head, another 14-year-old boy. We haven't compiled all these figures, and I'm getting reports from Ajit, the head of our OPT office, saying there was another big incident last night as well, which we're still trying to verify. Colleagues have pointed out the challenges of verifying information because we don't have eyes and ears on the ground. International press is not being allowed, and neither are we. We are doing what we can to try to verify these figures, but there's a time lag, and we will perhaps never be able to grasp the full scale of what's happening here because of the lack of access. On who is responsible, it is clear that the Israeli military has shelled and shot at Palestinians trying to reach the distribution points. how many killings, who is responsible for that. We need an investigation. We need access. We need an independent inquiry, and we need accountability for these killings.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ravina. Okay, I think lots of hands going up now. I understand. Let's go to John Zarakosis, and I'll get back to you, Jamie, then Agnes has a question. John, you've been waiting patiently, so over to you.
Yes. Good morning, Rick. I would like to hear your views on the killing of Dr. Marwan Al-Sultan, the director of the Indonesia Hospital, a renowned cardiosurgeon. How many doctors have been killed on duty or off duty? And is that triggering a reduction in staff, as we've seen in Iraq or Syria, from their working environments? Or are they staying there and continuing despite the high risks? Thank you.
Yeah, John, I think it's an... a good question. And yeah, I should have mentioned this actually in my introduction. Yeah, I think at WHO we're deeply saddened by the killing of the director of Indonesian hospital, including his children, his wife. I think the whole family has been killed. It's incredible. We really want to share any, of course, condolences to his family, his friends, etc. And there's many of them. And I think I saw also reports from also fellow health workers and grieving, because he was a great human being, but also a great medical doctor. We do not desecrate the killing of health workers In that sense, we have an overview on attacks on healthcare and as well. And I think it is recently being updated. We will try to get the figures to you as well. But yeah, having been on the Indonesian hospitals also many times, we knew him, we'd worked with him, we supported the Indonesian hospital, of course, with the other partners. And the hospital, as you know, is currently non-functional, should be functional. It's in this evacuation zone. It's in the so both Indonesian hospital Kamalat One, they're relatively very close to each other, and Al Adha, all those hospitals are non-functional. Again, sharing condolences with his family, friends, but also, of course, with all the health workers. And yes, of course, it has an impact. I mean, and I'm always surprised. Yesterday at Nasser Medical Complex, I met a few medical specialists, senior doctors, but also a few others who actually worked in Al Najjar Hospital in Rafah, the hospital which is the three hospitals in Rafah, which are all three non-functional anymore, and also in this evacuation zone and damaged or were partly destroyed, etc. The last time I was there, but we cannot even visit there anymore. So I'm always surprised that most of those health workers will then go and assist somewhere else. So this two were moved to Nasima Complex and are working there. Others, they moved to Shifa, for example, and work there. And we have seen this over time, but of course it has an impact, and specifically on let's say the top medical specialist, also with a number of them in the start of the crisis left Gaza and got their way out to Egypt. So it's part of the HR struggles and the problems, and that's why, by the way, it's also so important that we have the emergency medical teams. Bringing on the topic, that's emergency medical teams from all over the world to assist and specialized medical teams, which work either within those hospitals or in the field hospitals, and doing a fantastic job. We struggle in one area, and we've raised this, getting staff in. We see that a disproportionate number of health staff, especially for EMT, gets denied entry. So we've raised that multiple times. And that's maybe my small, complete different topic, because I find it very difficult to discuss about the passing away of the director. Maybe the one thing on the future. There's so much talk about this ceasefire and opening up of discussions, etc., and including that then supplies, you know, will be able to well, we should be able to get supplies out of our region and other areas, etc. I just want to plea again, let this happen, let this happen as soon as possible. Over to you.
Thanks, Rick. And of course, we at the UN express our condolences over the loss of Dr. Marwan Sultan, the director of the Indonesian Hospital in Gaza, and to his family. We have colleagues. I know there are lots more questions, and we do have other briefers waiting, but let's take these quickly. I'll go to Agnes from AFP, then back to you, Jamie. Agnes.
Yes, hi everybody. Thank you for taking my question. It's a question to Ravina, to the figures that you mentioned earlier, the 613 killings, both at GHF and near humanitarian convoys. Could you make the distinction, as you made it last week, about how many were killed at the GHF and how many at the near the humanitarian convoys? And could you specify, do you speak about UN humanitarian convoys, or because it's a bit too general, humanitarian convoys? And then the last question on those figures would be, if you could tell us if those figures have been verified by your office there. Thank you.
Thanks, Agnes. On the breakdown, no, I don't have it yet. I'm checking. I've been texting Ajit during this briefing. It can be difficult to get all the details immediately because the way that we gather the information is, for example, also from hospitals where they receive dead bodies. Now, we can count, but we can't immediately identify the location, attribution of responsibility. That takes a bit of time. But I am checking, and I'll get back to you as soon as I have it. So I don't have the breakdown of where... the breakdown of these 613, where they were killed. Did I answer your questions, or did you have something further on this?
Agnes, does that answer your question? I think...
Sorry, yes? I wasn't activated. One question is also, you say near humanitarian convoys. If you could be more specified, do you speak about UN humanitarian convoys or?
Yeah, no, sure. Let me get back to you on that as well. I don't have information on the exact location, but I can send you a note afterwards. As we're speaking, I'm getting further updates, so I can share those perhaps in a note after the briefing on locations and on the incident last night as well.
Yeah, thanks in advance for Orvina. And we'll take the last question, really. We have to move on. This is, again, from Jamie, AP.
Orvina, thank you very much. I just want to make sure I'm clear on that. You mentioned that 613 is since the beginning of operations in mid-May from GHF. Just to be clear, what the start date is of that 613 count. And just to be doubly clear, I know that you're going to catch me on this, but this is based on OHCHR's standard vetting process of the information, where you were as thorough as you possibly can be in terms of getting that. And it's obviously, it could be an undercount, presumably. Is that right?
Yes, so these figures are from the 27th of May onwards. You're correct about that, since the GHF started operating. On verification, yes, we are continuing to verify, and our figures always tend to be on the lower side. We get information from hospitals, cemeteries, families, from the Palestinian health authorities, from NGOs, from our partners on the ground, in order to try to corroborate it to the extent possible.
Thanks very much, Ravina. I think that concludes our discussion on Gaza. Rick, as always, thank you so very much. Stay safe, and please continue to join us here at the briefings. It's vitally important we hear from you. You're on the ground there, and as we've all agreed, we need more eyes and we need more reporting. We need justice and so much more. So thanks so very much, Rick, and good luck to you. Okay, we're going to Before I move to my colleague from IFRC, I'm going back to you, Antonio. You had a question on DRC. Babar is back on the podium, so please pose your question, and then we'll move on to Myanmar and the other topics. Go ahead.
Thank you, Rolando. So my question is if UNHCR has seen any movements, returns, or other figures in the week after the signing of the peace agreement between DRC and Rwanda.
Thank you, dear. I think I'm not sure if you saw the statement that we issued on Saturday welcoming DRC-Rwanda peace agreement as an opportunity to end cycles of displacement. High Commissioner Filippo Grandi has been quoted in there. If not seen, I can recirculate it. But just briefly, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, welcomes the agreement signed in Washington on June 27th between the Democratic Republic of the Congo and the Republic of Rwanda. We commend the efforts of regional and international partners who made this important milestone toward lasting peace and stability possible. As we all know, for decades, violence and instability in the DRC have forced millions of families to flee their homes, often multiple times, stripping them of safety and hopes for the future. This agreement offers a chance to stop the cycle of violence and displacement and focus on solutions that restore dignity, stability, and opportunity. We'll need to wait to see what colleagues report from on the ground. But we are aware, the figures show us that since the beginning of this year, 2025, nearly 120,000 people have fled DRC for neighboring countries. Also, prior to the signing of this agreement, days or during that week, violence and insecurity continued to displace people and also causing loss of life. So we'll keep monitoring the situation, and if there is any update, we'll come back to you. As we know, DRC, as mentioned, you know, has been running humanitarian situation and a displacement crisis for long. We have 1.1 million refugees who have fled DRC to the neighboring countries, majority to Uganda, but also inside the DRC, we have a huge number of displaced people who are internally displaced inside the country, and that figure is in the range of 7 million. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Babar, and you may have seen the statement that we also issued on behalf of the Secretary General on the reaching of this agreement over the weekend. So thanks very much for that. Thanks for the question. Yuri, is this for Babar by chance, or is this pointed to someone else?
No. It is for Ravina about Azerbaijan.
Okay, if you could hold on to that, and Ravina, I think she can stay on a little longer, she's telling me. So on that note, thanks, Babar. Once again, I'm happy to introduce Scott Craig from the IFRC, who's joining us here. He's a spokesperson for the IFRC, and he's going to introduce a colleague who's joining us, who's been very patient, I should say, who's IFRC's head of delegation in Myanmar, joining us from Yangon. But over to you, Scott.
Thanks, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. As we approach the 100-day mark since the devastating earthquakes in Myanmar, I'm pleased to introduce Nadia Khoury, our head of delegation in Myanmar, and she's here to give you an update on our humanitarian response as it enters a new phase. And just to remind you, we do also have spokespeople and audiovisual materials available for those of you who'd like to cover the story. Nadia, over to you.
Thank you for the opportunity to brief you today. On Sunday, 6th of July, it will be 100 days since two powerful earthquakes struck central Myanmar, taking lives, causing injuries, and destroying and damaging dozens of thousands of homes, schools, hospitals, and places of worship. We are taking stock of the achievements of the past 100 days, And we also know that the next 100 days will be critical because they will shape how people can move from survival to recovery and rebuild their lives. Alongside local communities, local responders, and the private sector, the Myanmar Red Cross volunteers, many of whom were themselves affected by the earthquakes, were amongst the first to respond. Today, they are still supporting communities across 5 earthquake-affected states and regions. And together with the IFRC and Red Cross, Red Crescent partners from all over the world, volunteers and staff of the Myanmar Red Cross have reached close to 200,000 people with a range of services, including emergency shelter, household items, healthcare, safe drinking water, and cash assistance. It is now raining heavily. We are closely monitoring the monsoon and will be ready to respond with additional relief items. In parallel, it is crucial now to restore the dignity and safety of affected people as quickly as possible during this early recovery period. Recovery means helping as many people as possible to return to their homes and supporting them in rebuilding their livelihoods. It's also significantly more costly than relief. For example, a single transitional shelter for a family can cost $1,200 compared to approximately $20 for a set of kitchen items or around $120 for an unconditional cash grant. Recovery will not only repair damage, but also address underlying vulnerabilities that are faced by families. It will be community-driven and informed by local needs and preferences. For us, this is a real window of opportunity to move from temporary solutions to permanent progress in a country where people are affected by so many different layers of disaster. For this reason, the IFRC is calling for even greater support of its Myanmar earthquake emergency appeal, helping people to move back to earthquake-resilient shelter. And rebuilding livelihoods takes more time and a larger investment than providing immediate relief. Still, our international emergency appeal has received only 22% of the funds needed to help the Myanmar Red Cross meet its earthquake response goals. Without increased support, we will not be able to reach the scale of recovery that communities urgently need at this critical juncture in what was already a fragile and complex situation. Thanks to the work of volunteers and staff of the MRCS and the IFRC and the strength of Myanmar's people, we are seeing real progress. And as part of this recovery, we see that communities themselves, and in particular women, are central to rebuilding with strength, hope, and dignity. I'd like to tell you about a 30-year-old mother from Amarapura in the Mandalay region. When the earthquake struck, she shielded her young son under a table as their home collapsed. And in the days and hours that followed, she herself helped to dig out other people's children from under the rubble with her bare hands. For 15 days, she and her family slept in a field. And when Red Cross volunteers arrived with tarpaulins, water, and dignity kits, it made an immediate and lasting difference. Today, she is also a volunteer herself and a leader of her local camp committee, helping others to recover. And she told one of my colleagues just last week, "If I can help others in this life, then maybe in the next life, I will be in a better place." This spirit of helping others despite immense personal suffering has been repeated throughout this crisis. The IFRC plays a critical role in providing technical expertise on long-term recovery and international coordination to assist the Myanmar Red Cross in these efforts and to mobilize international support for the next 100 days and well beyond. Today, the urgency is not over, but it is changing. The latest aftershock that was felt by our teams and communities in Mandalay and Sagaing was just yesterday morning at 7 a.m. with a magnitude of 4.9 on the Richter scale. That is considerable. The monsoon is here, diseases will be rising, and families in damaged homes and temporary shelters face new threats. Acting now can stop this from becoming a longer and ultimately more costly crisis. So we call on the international community to continue to stand with the people of Myanmar. The first 100 days after the earthquake were about survival, but the next 100 days will shape the future for thousands of families. I thank you, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Nadia. Very important brief from you. Do we have questions in the room starting? Online. Give it a second. No, I don't see that's the case. I think you were very comprehensive, and we really appreciate your brief. And of course, and for your patience, of course. So thank you very much, and please continue your great work, and we give you all the support. And for Scott, thanks for joining us. Scott Craig is our new colleague, not new. He's been in Geneva before, but with IFRC fairly recent. So we're going to share his contacts with you. So Nadia, thanks once again, and to you as well, Scott.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Merci. I will now turn to our colleagues, Monsieur Henri Monceau, and also we have Nobuntu Ndaluvo over the Giga Communication Manager. Merci pour votre patience. Monsieur Monceau, c'est l'observateur permanent de l'OVF pour une petite annonce. And please, if you want to join us as well at the same time, but I'll go immediately to you, sir. Thank you very much for your patience.
Merci beaucoup à vous. Et évidemment, il y a beaucoup de sujets, on vient de le voir, très importants. Mais une question qui est importante aussi, et notamment à Genève, c'est cet enjeu de la gouvernance du numérique et de l'intelligence artificielle. Vous savez qu'on vit un moment particulier, on vit un moment important, un tournant par rapport au modèle de gouvernance, puisque l'année dernière, le 23 septembre, très précisément, l'Assemblée générale a adopté le pacte numérique mondial, qui est le premier texte résultant d'une négociation intergouvernementale globale. Or, depuis deux décennies, la gouvernance du numérique est un enjeu qui est travaillé sur la base d'un modèle multipartite. Les gouvernements, certes, mais également la communauté technique, l'industrie, la société civile, le monde académique. Et c'est une structure qui a été mise en place à partir du Sommet mondial pour la société de l'information en 2003, réunion à Genève, 2005, réunion à Tunis. Et depuis lors, donc, 20 réunions successives. La 20e commencera lundi prochain, le 7 juillet, en même temps que le sommet de l'IA pour le bien commun, AI for Good. Et c'est important de bien comprendre cette perspective, parce que ce que devra faire cette réunion suivie du SMSI, c'est remettre des propositions à l'Assemblée générale des Nations Unies, propositions qui feront l'objet d'une décision décembre prochain. Il y a trois grands enjeux. Il y a l'architecture de la gouvernance, comment trouver un équilibre entre le modèle intergouvernemental et le modèle multipartite. Il y a le cadre de gouvernance pour l'intelligence artificielle au sein des Nations Unies, le dialogue pour l'IA. Et il y a un troisième dossier qui est également travaillé ici à Genève. En ce moment même, se tient d'ailleurs une réunion du groupe de travail sur la gouvernance des données de la Commission pour la science et la technologie pour le développement, qui, vous le savez, est abritée par la CNUSET, par UNCTAD. Nous sommes vraiment dans un moment qui est assez décisif, même si, bien entendu, l'actualité internationale tragique que nous venons d'entendre encore ne permet pas toujours d'apporter l'attention qui est nécessaire. Mais ce qui est en jeu, c'est évidemment, à travers ce modèle de gouvernance, des questions qui sont fondamentales sur la qualité de l'information, par exemple, sur la souveraineté numérique et la manière dont les données sont utilisées, sur l'accès que pourront avoir des cultures, des peuples à l'IA, parce que l'intelligence artificielle, elle est basée sur des données numérisées. Si vous parlez le Lingala, le Swahili ou le Wolof, vous avez peu de données numérisées. Et donc, il y a un risque vraiment qui est capital sur le plan culturel et linguistique. C'est la raison pour laquelle la francophonie mobilise tous les acteurs du numérique de l'espace francophone, des 90 pays que comprend la francophonie, ici à Genève, ce week-end, donc le samedi 5 demain et le dimanche 6, autour de ces problématiques, très exactement autour des questions que j'évoquais, l'inclusion numérique, la diversité culturelle et linguistique, la gouvernance des données. Plus de 50 intervenants, dont l'envoyé pour les technologies du secrétaire général des Nations Unies, Amandeep Singh Gill, dont le secrétaire général adjoint de l'UIT, le directeur général adjoint de l'UNESCO, Taoufik Djellassi, la présidente de Internet Society et bien d'autres. J'ai un programme à votre disposition. Les notes conceptuelles et autres éléments relatifs à cet événement. Et bien entendu, nous sommes à votre disposition pour répondre à toutes questions ou pour vous donner davantage d'informations sur cette importante réunion. Merci beaucoup.
Oui, c'est important. J'aurai ensuite une petite annonce de l'OIT sur le même sujet après. Do we have questions for Monsieur Monceau? Non, je pense que c'est très clair. Merci beaucoup, Monsieur.
Merci à vous.
Pour votre patience aussi. Now we will turn to our colleague from Giga UNICEF and Ubuntu Nudlovu, Giga Communication Manager, who is joining us for an important update on the Giga Connectivity Forum 2025. Yeah. Over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be briefing you today. I'm here to invite you all to the Giga Connectivity Forum, which is taking place next week on the sidelines of WISIS and AI for Good. Now, before I get into the Connectivity Forum, I also want to just quickly position us as Giga to explain who we are and what our mission is. GIGA is a joint initiative between UNICEF and ITU, and our sole mission is to support governments in connecting schools to the internet by 2030 and ensuring that every young person has access to information, opportunity, and choice. Now, this is very important for us to note because next week we'll be understanding more how technology is moving at a critically fast pace and what it means for other communities out there that are not connected to the world. We are all aware of the digital economy, the digital divide, and the huge gap that is increasing as we continue to talk about AI, generative AI, and all the other exciting things that we see when we're looking at a global society that's at the cusp of growing within the technology ecosystem. Whilst that's happening, on our end, we are looking at the grassroots movements, understanding that schools are being left behind. We view schools as centers of community, or schools are hubs that sprout digital economy opportunities within each community. When we connect a school, we are enabling communities to be connected and giving communities access to the digital economy in ways that they would have not previously experienced. To quickly give you some stats in terms of what we've achieved so far, as GIGA, we operate with four models, which is map, model, finance, and contract. We go into countries and we basically want to map the schools to understand where they are. When we map the schools, we are able to understand what the big challenge looks like. How many schools are connected? How many schools are not? But connecting schools is not enough because we also need to do the modeling to understand the infrastructure that is required to support these schools. And we work with governments to model and finance, partnering with them to enable them to understand what the best procurement practices could look like. Connectivity is an expensive commodity. It is highly privatized. And when we partner with governments, we're looking to consult and work with them from a contracting perspective. being the middleman to actually enable them to drive pooled procurement as part of a model. So we have a procurement team within the contracting ecosystem that works to pool this demand. We've partnered with the likes of Smart Africa and UNECA to drive this agenda forward. So when you come to our Giga Connectivity Forum next week, these are some of the opportunities or conversations that you'll be able to take part in. Specific to the media, at the Giga Connectivity Forum, we have a session on the 9th of July at 10 a.m. where we've opened it for you to come and have this conversation with us. We'll have our Giga co-leads, Alex and Chris, who will be joining us. And in that session, we would like to open the floor to have you ask them important questions that can bring visibility to the work that we're doing. As we continue to do this within this ecosystem at the Connectivity Forum itself, we're going to be having ministerial delegates from the Ministries of Education, Ministries of ICT, coming together to convene and learn what best practice could look like. As mentioned earlier, we've mapped 2.2 million schools. We have 24,000 active schools, and this is resulting in 11 million children benefiting in connectivity. This is not enough. We need to have public and private conversations that gather and unite people to understand the job that needs to be done. With technology moving at such a fast pace, we fear that there's going to be a huge gap and a huge disconnect across the globe. Within the Global Connectivity Forum that we're hosting, it's not just the Global South or the Global North. It's a combined effort of countries across Europe, Central Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa, just to name a few, who will be coming in to convene and share best practices, looking at some of their countries, what has worked for them. We recently had a Europe and Central Africa session where we heard from ministries of Turkey, we heard from ministries of Bosnia and Herzegovina, seeing the amount of work that they've been doing successfully to map their schools and how they've been managing to lift their schools into the digital economy is something that we want to spread across the various communities that we work in. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Lots going on, and very important work you're doing. Yeah. So thank you so very much for briefing our colleagues here. Do we have questions? No, I don't see that's the case. Thank you. Very comprehensive, and good luck next week.
Thank you.
I will, colleagues, I will announce something from the ITU momentarily. But before I do that, I'll go back to Yuri, who had a question on Azerbaijan, if I'm not mistaken, for Ravina. Yuri, back to you.
Yes, thank you, Rolando. Hi, Ravina. My question is about the journalists that were arrested from Sputnik Azerbaijan. I just wanted to know if you are following the situation. Seven of them were arrested. Five that had the nationality of Azerbaijan and Russia were released yesterday, and they are now blocked at home. But two of them, who are only Russian citizens, are still in jail. We also, in the court, the video that was published, when we see that they were beaten. They were all beaten without doubt. And more than journalists, there is also two Russian citizens who are working in informatics that were also arrested and also beaten. I just wanted to know if you are following that and if you are calling for the release of the journalists. Thank you.
Thanks, Yuri. Yes, we are following the situation. We're aware of these cases. We're looking into getting more details. Once we have more details, we can have a better understanding of what's going on. But generally, I think you're aware that the High Commissioner has raised concerns about respect for media freedoms in Azerbaijan and the treatment of journalists and media workers. He has raised concerns also about the arbitrary detention, not only of journalists, but also of activists and other individuals who have been arbitrarily deprived of their liberty.
Thank you very much, Ravina. I think Jeremy Lange at FE might have a question for you as well, if you can hold on just a moment. Jeremy, is this for Ravina?
Yes, this is for Ravina. Thank you, Rolando. A question on Ukraine, maybe for Ravina. It seems like the Dutch and German intelligence confirmed that Russia used chemical weapons again in Ukraine. Ukraine, who suffered the largest drone attack yesterday. I want to know if you have any info on that, on the chemical weapons used in Ukraine. Thank you, Ravina.
Thanks, Jeremy. Yes, indeed, we're aware of that report. We ourselves have not documented specific civilian casualties caused by chemical weapons. However, colleagues tell me that the OPCW has confirmed the presence of toxic chemicals on several occasions, that there has confirmed the use of toxic chemicals against Ukraine on several occasions. So perhaps you would like to consult them. We have documented the use of many different weapons, obviously, by Russia in Ukraine, including the use of cluster munitions in heavily populated areas. And the High Commissioner has repeatedly warned that due to the wide area effects of cluster munitions, their use in populated areas is incompatible with international humanitarian law. We've also documented the use of mines and other heavy weaponry. And you are, of course, aware of the severe overnight attacks in Ukraine, where we understand loitering munitions and missiles were used. So we can share with you a number of different weapons that Russia has used in Ukraine, which raise serious concerns about compliance with international humanitarian law. On the issue of chemical weapons specifically, though, I would refer you to the OPCW.
Well noted. Thank you so much, Ravina. Colleagues, you will have seen the update that Ocha shared with you last night, which speaks to what Ravina just mentioned, these airstrikes in Ukraine, which over the past 3 days have killed and injured civilians, including 10 civilians killed and nearly 60 injured, including children. So do take a look at that update that was shared with you last night from Ocha. Thanks again, Ravina. Okay, I think that leaves me to just announce a few things as... promised. I have a short announcement from the ITU. You've heard from our colleagues, the OAF colleague and GIGA colleague, about WISIS, the so-called WISIS, the World Summit of Information Society, plus 20 high-level event starting Monday. This will last throughout the week until the 11th of July, so 7th to 11th July, and stakeholders from over 150 countries will help shape the vision for the next phase of the world's digital transformation. The outcomes will contribute directly to the UN General Assembly's 20-year review of WISIS, scheduled for December 2025 in New York. Now, also on Monday, there is a press tour at PALEXPO of the AI for Good and WISIS conference facilities. Exhibitors and their AI technology will be on display. Reporters are asked to arrive early to receive their press badges at PALEXPO. The event begins at 1700 at 5 p.m., so please arrive to PALEXPO by 4 p.m. or 4:30, the latest, to avoid missing the tour start. Just one more moment. On Tuesday, the AI for Good Global Summit 2025 opens, and that also runs through the end of the week to the 11th of July. The AI governance standards, skills, and capacity will be in focus at the event, featuring talks from AI leaders and 100-plus demos showcasing AI innovations to deliver better healthcare and education, reduce risk disaster risks, ensure water and food security, and bolster economic resilience. So there is a press conference on AI superhumanity scheduled, AI superhumanity scheduled for Wednesday, the 9th of July at PALEXPO at 12 noon. Media advisories have already been sent out. More to follow. Event badges are required. Just to repeat that, and if you have not already registered, please do so. And any questions, of course, direct to pressinfo@itu.int. That's a message from our colleagues at ITU. Almost done. Just to mention that Secretary General Antonio Guterres is leaving tomorrow for Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, where he will attend the 17th summit of the BRICS countries. Now, this is... he'll be there for a couple of days, and the SG has been invited to speak at an outreach session on, quote, strengthening multilateralism, economic financial affairs, and artificial intelligence, end quote. Now, that will take place on Sunday, this coming Sunday, the 6th of July. Now, on Monday, the 7th of July, the Secretary General will address the second outreach session on the environment, COP30, and global health. And during his visit, Secretary General Guterres will also be having a host of bilaterals attending the BRICS summit, and we will, of course, share the readouts with you once we receive them. I've already referred to the message from the Secretary General that we issued last night on Gaza. So please take a look at that. In terms of meetings here, we have the Committee on the Elimination of Discriminations Against Women, CEDAW, concluding its 91st session this afternoon after having issued its concluding observations on the countries reviewed during the session, namely Mexico, Thailand, Ireland, Afghanistan, San Marino, Chad, and Botswana. And the Human Rights Committee is continuing its session throughout the next couple of weeks. This morning, it concluded its review on the report of Haiti. So you take a look at the media advisory with more information on the succeeding reviews for the Human Rights from the Human Rights Committee. Human Rights Council, Pascal shared with you updates, as usual, daily updates. They're speaking to the situation of technical cooperation in the Syria, the context of human rights. But we're told that at roughly 4 p.m. this afternoon, the Human Rights Council will commence action on various resolutions and decisions that are put forward to it for action, 26 in total. I'm told that the action will start around 4 o'clock once again on a resolution concerning Eritrea. So do take a look at the proceedings in room 20. And that is all I have. So, questions? No? On that note, I bid you a good afternoon, a nice weekend. See you here on Tuesday.